Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
On Radio National, abc.net.au/rn, welcome to Encounter. I'm David Rutledge, and this week, a program that sheds light on one of the darker aspects of human experience, the problem or the mystery of undeserved suffering.
Terrible disasters pose, I think, some of the most difficult questions. A forest burns, a plane crashes, a car with young children in overturns and the occupants are killed. There is this fault line that runs through human experience, the fault line of suffering, and we just don't know why.
It's better not to believe in God than it is to believe in a God who would do such a thing. It's actually better to be agnostic about God than it is to say, no, I think God is a vengeful God who inflicts suffering upon people.
People may emerge from crisis either bitter or able to struggle. And part of the positive aspect of struggle is to move on, to be transformed. I mean, that's easy for me to sit here and say that. I haven't had my house burned down or seen any members of my family taken by fire. But I think it's a fruitless and inappropriate question to say, why is God doing this to me? Because that doesn't seem to be how it works.
At any given moment, you can choose whether to, I don't know, go to the beach or read a book, whether to marry this person or that person. And he thinks that these possibilities and the choices we make to some extent shape who we are and who we can become. And I think this emphasis on choice is something that's very important to the discussion of illness and suffering, because even though the illness and the suffering might be unavoidable and inflicted on you by an external process, you still have the choice as to how to respond to it.
There once was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. That man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He had 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 donkeys, and very many servants. So that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. One day the heavenly beings came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking up and down on it." The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil." Then Satan answered the Lord, "Skin for skin. All that people have they will give to save their lives. But stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well, he is in your power. Only spare his life." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and inflicted loathsome sores on Job, from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. Job took a potsherd with which to scrape himself, and sat among the ashes.
The book of Job in the Hebrew Bible tells the story of a righteous man who, through no fault of his own, is afflicted with the worst kind of pain. He loses his family, his fortune, and as we've just heard, he loses his health. The catalyst for all this is a kind of heavenly wager between God and one of his associates, but it doesn't make any earthly sense. The suffering of Job flies in the face of all human concepts of morality and justice, and that's partly the point of the story. Suffering is beyond human understanding, in spite of the fact that centuries of religious and secular thought have delved deep into the question of why bad things happen to people who don't deserve them. It's a pressing question. Even those of us who are lucky enough to escape large-scale tragedy like the Victorian bushfires are very lucky indeed if we manage to escape suffering altogether. And of course we all die, even if few of us really believe that we deserve that. Well, this week we'll be hearing that reflection and philosophy and theology can only take us so far. In the end, the meaning of suffering lies in the experience itself. Which brings us back to Job, a story that expresses extreme scepticism about received wisdom. Laurie Woods is Senior Lecturer in Biblical Studies at the Australian Catholic University.
I see Job as a dissident. He's confronted with an awful experience, a pretty harrowing experience, and it's an experience that he hasn't had before, because the way the book of Job opens, Job is presented with everything. And he's a wealthy man, he's the biggest name in the East. People come to him for advice, and they come to him for help, and he advises and counsels, and he's in control. Satan, of course, comes along, or the accuser, he's always referred to in the Hebrew Bible as the Satan, the accuser. And his task then is to test Job by taking all this away to see how Job reacts to the suffering. And when his friends come along to show sympathy, and then they respond to him by saying, well, you've obviously done something wrong or you wouldn't be suffering like this. And so then I think the poetry revolves around this idea of, but he hasn't done anything wrong, and this suffering seems gratuitous.
And that's where it goes against the conventional Hebrew wisdom, isn't it, which is that virtue is rewarded and sinfulness is punished.
Well, that's right. But then his friends are agents, if you like, of conventional Hebrew wisdom. And this is why they're saying, well, you've got to admit that you've done something wrong, repent and all this will go away. And Job insists, but I haven't done anything wrong. And he gets to the point where he says to them, and your counsel is like desert streams. It's there in the rainy season. As soon as the rain's gone, it goes away, it withers. And you guys are just sort of blowing in the wind and you're not making much sense. And I think one of the deep poetic aspects of Job's response to his friends is, I'm feeling this, I'm experiencing this, you guys aren't. I agreed with you once upon a time. I thought the good guys did well and the bad guys suffered, and that's the way God ordained things. But this awful experience has taught me it ain't so, it's just not like that. And your answers are not striking home with me, and they seem pretty empty.
Laurie Woods. As well as existential mysteries, Job presents deep theological problems, and it's not surprising that there are few texts in the Hebrew Bible that have generated such a large and diverse body of interpretation. Robert Eisen is Professor of Religion and Judaic Studies at George Washington University.
What I discovered in the course of my research is that, in fact, there's a strain in medieval Jewish philosophy. In fact, one very well-known Jewish philosopher in particular, Maimonides, a famous 12th century Jewish philosopher who wrote on the Book of Job. And according to this way of thinking, suffering isn't there in order to punish you for your sins. It's there to teach you that you need to loosen your connection, you need to reject your connection with the material world and focus on your spiritual life with God. And that's a very radical reading. I mean, one of the things that has impressed me most about my research in this is that Jews, even in the Middle Ages, when everyone was supposed to be, you know, very, orthodox, faithful Jews, many of them were entertaining these radical readings of the Book of Job.
It's interesting that this comes up, this idea of one's relationship with God, because Job also, in God, in the God in the text, it brings up a figure which is in some ways morally problematic. And there's one guest on this program who says that it's better to be agnostic than to believe in the God of Job, given how morally problematic that God is. And I wonder if you agree with that the Book of Job is an encouragement to agnosticism, much like the Book of Ecclesiastes.
Well, what many medieval and modern Jewish interpreters do is say that we don't have a God in this text who necessarily knows everything that we do, who implements a calculus in which suffering is always a punishment for sin, that we have to kind of get past that. So agnostic, no, but certainly what a lot of interpreters have seen in it in the Jewish tradition is something that goes against that punishing personal God who, you know, is examining your every move and punishing you for anything you've done wrong.
Robert Eisen, and we'll be hearing more from him later in the program. Job's friends, who sit with him in his distress, take it upon themselves to explain why such a terrible fate has befallen him.
But the best explanation they can come up with is that he is being punished. Somewhere at some time he must have sinned. Job knows that he's innocent, and he cries out against the treatment being unjustly meted out to him, demanding that God should give an account of himself. Well, the notion that we bring misfortune upon ourselves is a familiar one, and for many hundreds of years the idea that Job was the author of his own suffering persisted in Jewish traditions of interpretation. The idea that God would torment Job for no good reason was too theologically confronting to entertain. But that changed with the Holocaust.
The Holocaust, happening after the Enlightenment, happens when people already ask very specific questions about the way God behaves.
Jason Kalman is professor of classical Hebrew text and interpretation at the Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati.
The Holocaust, happening after the Enlightenment, happens when people already ask very specific questions about the way God behaves. To add to that, you have just the gross scale of the Holocaust and the number of victims who had survived the events but who still had to confront it. So I think there is a need to find a religious response that isn't the Holocaust happened because of something that we did or something that the victims did. And so there needs to be a reformulation that says there is a biblical text that speaks to an occasion when there can be suffering without sin. And so readers after the Holocaust turned to the book of Job, but largely rejected the inherited interpretive tradition.
Which was that Job must have done something wrong.
Correct. So now you've created a different theological problem. If Job has done nothing wrong, how do I explain God's actions? And so in certain cases, readers have basically argued that there are times when God does not behave justly and that becomes human responsibility. Elie Wiesel, for example, has written that even though God behaves in an unjust manner with regard to Job, Job is really at his greatest point heroic for standing up to God, for challenging God. And as such, human beings have a responsibility in the face of all injustice, whether divine or human, to stand up for the righteous.
So it's a mode of interpretation that focuses more on the figure of Job than on the figure of God and the sorts of problems that arise from a God who behaves in the way he does.
I think that's true. I think in the pre-Holocaust tradition, you have the idea that you can defend God's justice in certain ways by condemning Job. In the post-Holocaust period, because there's a sense that one cannot blame the victim, one has to find a way to redeem Job even at the expense of God's justice.
It brings up this question of why, which is not answered in the text. You know, why do these terrible things happen to Job? Why do the righteous suffer? Why does God allow suffering? If that question is not answered, if we take away that question, what kinds of questions are we left with? Is Job in some sense a book about how to suffer?
Well, it may be. Certainly contemporary Jewish thinkers have tried to read it that way. The question of the what of suffering really becomes dominant. Since I've now suffered, what do I do as a result? Certainly Job's attempts to seek out God, to try and find the just path, is a model that becomes important. Certainly, Job's challenges to God's justice take on a particularly important role after the Holocaust. Not to explain the why of suffering, but how one should respond. That is, we should always demand justice. We should always learn from the event. If I can't learn about God, at the very least, I should be able to learn how to respond to that suffering, either by becoming more empathetic or by actually physically going out and taking what I've learned from the disaster to help avoid future disasters.
Jason Kalman. You're listening to Encounter on Radio National, abc.net.au/rn. This week, an encounter with questions about human suffering.
Can mortals be righteous before God? Can human beings be pure before their Maker? Even in his servants he puts no trust, and his angels he charges with error. How much more those who live in houses of clay, whose foundation is in the dust, who are crushed like a moth. Between morning and evening they are destroyed. For misery does not come from the earth, nor does trouble sprout from the ground. But human beings are born to trouble, just as the sparks fly upward.
Thank you.
music from last month's Ash Wednesday service at St James Anglican Church in Sydney. Ash Wednesday marks the beginning of the Christian season of Lent, a time for repentance and the contemplation of our mortality. The symbolism of ashes has been particularly poignant this year, as many are still trying to come to terms with the tragedy of the recent bushfires in Victoria. Peter Curti is the rector of St James Church.
Historically in the church, ash has always been a sign of mourning. I think that's because ash is the remainder of something that's been burned. It's all that we have left. And it's a reminder to us that one day we too will return to ash, that the lives we lead will end, our bodies that we know and value will return to dust. So it's a very powerful symbol of not so much death, but ending and a recognition that ending is going to happen. And on Ash Wednesday, we remember the fact of our separateness. We remember the fact that we need to try to grow closer to God in our own relationship.
So when you talk about the disconnection from God, then you're not drawing that connection that many within the church do draw between sin and suffering. We have suffering in the world because there is sin in the world.
Well, I think to some extent we can say that suffering does arise because of our alienation from God. But I think that the idea that suffering is somehow a punishment for our sinfulness is wrong. And I think it becomes very difficult, if one adopts that position, to explain why innocent people suffer, why it is that the innocent, the young, the vulnerable are struck down with disease or are afflicted by trauma or suffer in accidents. Terrible disasters, such as the bushfire disasters, pose some of the most difficult questions. And I think one of the important things for Christians to remember is that when that kind of suffering does happen, God's love for us has not been destroyed. And in fact, I know that many of my colleagues working with those who have suffered in the bushfires in Victoria have wanted to talk about new life and about the possibilities for new beginning and the fact that love and meaning and purpose in life are not defeated or destroyed by disaster. It's a difficult concept to speak about in the midst of the suffering. But I think it's very important that we shouldn't start to attribute miserable experience to a particular existential state of human being.
When you talk about the love of God, though, this makes me wonder about the book of Job, a book that directly addresses itself to the riddle of undeserved suffering. And the answer there is, not only is there no answer, but there appears to be very little love coming from the divinity either. I mean, Job's sitting among the ashes and scraping his sores and asserting his innocence, and God appears to him and says, well, it's got nothing to do with innocence. I can do whatever I want. He kind of slaps Job across the face with that answer. What do you make of that particular lesson?
I think the book of Job is one of the most extraordinary books in the Bible and is really an extended experiment in theology and philosophy, in a way. Because here is Job, who is being put through a series of experiences in order to test his faithfulness. And we often associate Job with suffering, because indeed he did suffer. But what is at the heart of the book of Job is that no matter what was thrown at Job, no matter what affliction befell him, he did not give up his faith in God. He did not give up his belief that God loved him and knew him and cared for him, even though it made no sense intellectually. In his spirit and in his heart, he knew that God continued to love him. So I think for Christians, the book of Job is a very important book, because it's a reminder to us that we shouldn't, as it were, rate our faith in God according to how we're feeling or what we're experiencing. Just because things are going well doesn't mean to say that we are in a better or worse relationship with God, because when things go badly, our relationship with God can still remain. And that's what we learn from the book of Job.
Peter Curti. Well, if the wisdom of Job offers religious consolation to religious adherents, what does it say to those of us who are not religious? Mark Vernon is an author and honorary research fellow in philosophy at the University of London. He's also a former Anglican priest who left the church in 1995. Mark agrees that Job poses fascinating questions, but he believes that philosophy, like theology, is limited in its capacity for answering them.
I think the problem of evil, as it's often put, the question of how a good God could cause suffering, is perhaps the most pressing question, both for believers who believe in God, but also for atheists who don't. And I think the problem of evil is the best reason, if you like, not to believe in God. I think that the answer to suffering, if there can be an answer, that the book of Job tries to give, is to say that it's beyond us to understand why it is that people suffer, and particularly why people seem to needlessly suffer. However, this book has provoked a lot of very interesting reflections upon the question of suffering. And one of them, which I think is the most interesting, is was that given by the psychoanalyst Carl Gustav Jung. And he said that the book of Job posed this great problem to God because Job suffers needlessly. It's not righteous suffering. There's a cry that goes out for justice. And so God has to answer this. And in Jung's understanding, the answer was the birth of Christianity and the idea that God comes as a man and dies in suffering himself. He talked about Jesus being God's answer to Job. He wrote a book called Answer to Job, which was precisely that. And that's a very interesting idea. Again, it's not like a once and for all answer, but it's a very interesting reflection about the relationship between ourselves and our divinities. For myself, I think it's very arresting that the book of Job's in the Bible at all, because it does pose such a deep and penetrating problem. It does seem to put God in the dock and find God wanting, which, if you think about it, is quite an extraordinary thing. Actually, I think it's better not to believe in God than it is to believe in a God who would do such a thing. It's actually better to be agnostic about God than it is to say, no, I think God is a vengeful God who inflicts suffering upon people. And the reason for that is that that would make God less than human.
To what extent have you yourself pursued this why question? Why do we suffer? And where has that sort of questioning led you?
One answer to the question of why we suffer is that it's a necessary part of our makeup. It's just what it is to be biological creatures, to be psychological creatures. There's no happiness without sadness. There are no good things in life without struggle. It doesn't seem to be a hugely satisfactory answer to me for two reasons. One is that it seems rather calculating. And if there's one thing not to be when it comes to trying to deal with suffering, that is calculating. Reason compounds suffering, if you like.
So when you say that reason compounds suffering, is that partly a warning, if you like, about the limits of philosophical answers to suffering?
Yeah, I think that what philosophical reflections upon suffering can do is that they can try and sort of pinpoint what the real issues are. But I don't think there's any reasoning out of suffering.
So you're saying that there's no ultimate sense to be made of it. It's just enough to learn to deal with it practically.
I don't think there's any rational sense to be made of it, but there is perhaps an experiential sense to be made of it. I mean, one of the things which I noticed when I was a priest is that often the times when people are suffering very greatly, when you know they've got ill children or when someone who's loved has died, they're often the most meaningful moments in people's lives. It's then that they know that they really love the person who has gone or that they really care for the child. They're very intense experiences in some way that they never felt so alive as during that time. So there's a mystery here, if you like, that whilst you would never will that suffering upon people, it can be a very profound experience.
Mark Vernon. And on Radio National, abc.net.au/rn, you're listening to Encounter.
The most traumatic time is the time of diagnosis, where you're confused and you're scared and you look it up on the internet and it looks really terrible and you think, how am I ever going to learn to live with this, and why me, what's happened, what have I done to deserve this, and there's a lot of guilt and various other kinds of negative emotions like anger and despair. I think in the deepest sense, it's just the kind of thing that is with you all the time, so there isn't really a moment in the day or even in the night when I'm not conscious of the fact that this thing has happened to me. But you learn to maybe contain it in some way so it's not sort of destructive and doesn't sort of take over your whole life.
Javi Carrell is Senior Lecturer in Philosophy at the University of the West of England in Bristol, and she's also the author of a book entitled Illness. It's part of a series on the art of living, edited by Mark Vernon. In 2006, Javi Carrel was diagnosed with a rare and incurable lung disease called lymphangioleiomyomatosis, or LAM. It affects women at the rate of around 1 in 400,000 and involves renegade cells growing into the lungs and destroying healthy lung tissue. The official medical prognosis of life expectancy is 10 years from the onset of serious symptoms. Well, as a philosopher, Javi has spent a good deal of time thinking and writing about her experience and her reflections on mortality. But to what extent has her experience elicited a religious response?
Religious, certainly not. Even though I've seen a lot of people benefit psychologically a lot from thinking that other people are praying for them and from praying themselves and feeling that, you know, God's around looking after things, I think it would be quite incompatible for me to think that there is an intelligent sort of designer who made this happen to me. I find it a lot more plausible and also a lot simpler to just think that this is one of those blind, you know, physiological processes over which we have no control. But I do feel there is a spiritual response that is quite subtle. So it's not that I felt I sort of developed a new dimension to my life, but it certainly makes you maybe be more thoughtful, maybe pay more attention to smaller things, and maybe learn to cultivate a sense of well-being that isn't physical well-being, and isn't actually just psychological, but is something I would call spiritual. So you feel you know your place in the world, you feel you're sort of attuned to what's happening to you, you feel more at peace with yourself, and that does certainly have a spiritual dimension to it that I don't think I paid much attention to before.
Well, the central text in this program is the Book of Job, and I know you're a secular Jew, but you'll be familiar with the story of Job and what happens to him. The central philosophical question in that text is the question of why God afflicts Job with suffering. And to what extent have you pursued that question of why?
I think in the beginning it's a very prominent question because you feel like you've been singled out and punished. And I think a lot of people really unfairly and destructively go through a phase of feeling guilty and trying to find reasons in their past. So was it, you know, that cigarette I smoked when I was 15? Was it because I didn't eat enough vegetables? And so on. And after a while, you stop thinking about that because you come to realize that not everything in our life, in fact, most things in our life, are not within our own control. And that, I think that's a great relief to stop thinking about that, because there isn't any particular reason why one person gets ill or one person's house burns down and another person's doesn't. The meaning is in learning to say, now that this thing has happened, it's not that my life lacks meaning, or it's not that a previously meaningful life has now become chaotic, but to think to yourself of the ways in which a life that is to some extent damaged can still be a meaningful life. And for me, learning to live well with illness was key.
In your book, you write about the philosopher Martin Heidegger, who saw human existence as being characterized by its potential, the capacity to become this or that, and to orient oneself towards certain plans and goals. In a situation where your plans and goals have become curtailed through illness, how does Heidegger help? How does that idea of identity through potential work constructively for you?
Heidegger had very interesting views on death, and he thought about human life as what he calls being towards death. He said every day we're just in a constant sort of movement in time, which is a movement towards death. So every day you're one day closer to your death. And a lot of people think that this is kind of a morbid philosophy, but I think his actual thought is much more positive. I think what he's trying to say is that we should consider very carefully each moment and each day we live, and live it with a full understanding of its uniqueness and singularity, and live it with a full understanding of ourselves as finite. As to what he means by ability to be, he has a very existential, very open view of human life as being a set of possibilities. So at any given moment, you can choose whether to, I don't know, go to the beach or read a book, whether to marry this person or that person. And he thinks that these possibilities and the choices we make to some extent shape who we are and who we can become. But on the other hand, this is also limited by something he calls thrownness. So it's not like your freedom is completely unlimited, but it's actually sort of circumscribed to some extent by your past experiences, so your history, your family, the culture and historical period into which you were born. All of these limit you in some ways, but there's also this huge big openness and choice. And I think this emphasis on choice is something that's very important to the discussion of illness and suffering, because even though the illness and the suffering might be unavoidable and inflicted on you by an external process, you still have the choice as to how to respond to it. The discovery for me that I was the only person who could decide how to respond to it, how I would respond to it, was an immense sense of freedom, precisely because it restores some of the sense of autonomy that is really massively damaged, at least initially, when you become ill.
How have you been able to exercise that? What sort of choices have you been able to make? What sort of autonomy have you come into?
Well, the first and the most significant one was the kinds of attitudes I had towards my illness and towards the various unpleasant aspects of it that came along with it. So I've had to undergo a lot of sort of invasive physical tests. And, you know, like anything, you can make a big fuss of it, or you can just say, well, you know, this is for my own good and I just need to go through it. And there's various other ways of being kind to yourself that took a while to discover. So I think a lot of people tend to be too hard on themselves and say, oh, I've got to stay tough and I've got to keep myself together and I've got to not tell other people what I'm going through and so on. And I think this is, again, not a particularly good attitude, good choice to make, because even though the social aspects of illness can be very painful, there's also a sense in which other people can often sort of support and help you at the times when you're the most vulnerable.
The Buddhist take on suffering has it that we suffer because of our attachments. What are you hanging on to and what are you letting go of? What are you free from?
Well, you're free from a lot of small and irritating things. For example, you know, if I scratch my car when I'm parking, or if I lose something, or if all the million little things that people, I think, use as excuses for their unhappiness, these things almost completely disappear from your life. And that's, again, that's a very positive aspect of illness, is that you really get a chance to reevaluate what is and isn't important, and you become free of a lot of the small things and concerns that people have about how they look and how much money they make, and their material possessions, because all of these things really become extremely trivial and you no longer pay much attention to them. So you definitely become more free and you definitely let go of a lot of things. But then you also, at the end of the day, you are the one who's lying there at night thinking about all the things that could go wrong and all the things that did go wrong. And there's, you know, there's an undeniable element of sadness and, I don't know, I think it takes a lot of your energy to keep life going and to keep yourself together in the face of illness.
Talking about attachment makes me think about the familiar metaphors that we have for dealing with illness, and they're sort of military metaphors, you know, battle and triumph and defeat, and this idea that the illness is an enemy with whom you engage in this kind of very closely identified struggle. Is that sort of metaphor appropriate to your own experience?
No, I actually think these whole sort of militaristic metaphors are incredibly inapt. I don't think they capture at all what's going on. I mean, you're not really battling because you haven't got that much ammunition, and ultimately, if a disease is going to ravage your body and kill you, then all the, you know, strength of character and strength of spirit you might show isn't going to help you. And I think there's something actually quite dangerous about these metaphors as well, because they imply that if you die from an illness, it's because you haven't battled strong enough. So I think, no, it's not a battle. I think it's a lot more, I don't know, maybe an adjudication, maybe an arbitration, maybe learning how to coexist with your illness. But I think that thinking of it as the enemy is precisely the kind of negative picture that will make you think, oh, you know, I've been cursed, I've been punished, why me, and all this kind of stuff that we talked about earlier. I think the much more productive picture is one where you say, okay, so I'm confronted with an obstacle. I'm confronted with a limitation. I'm confronted with something terrible that has happened to me. What do I do now? How do I carry on? How do I continue to live meaningfully with this thing? So without denying it and without thinking of it as the enemy, but just thinking of it as yet another kind of limitation. And it's not the only kind of limitation, right? I mean, we constantly live with various kinds of limitations, intellectual and financial, and we constantly experience disappointments in love and in careers and so on and so forth. So it's not a kind of alien thought to think that ill health is just another kind of limitation that we can certainly learn to coexist with. And I think even in the most extreme situations, people are often able to make peace with their own situation, their own condition, in ways that maybe their families aren't so able to.
Javi Carrel. This is Encounter, and you're listening to it on Radio National, abc.net.au/rn.
Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up your loins like a man. I will question you, and you shall declare to me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? Have you entered into the springs of the sea, or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been revealed to you, or have you seen the gates of deep darkness? Have you comprehended the expanse of the earth? Declare if you know all this. Who has cut a channel for the torrents of rain and a way for the thunderbolt, to bring rain on a land where no one lives, on the desert, which is empty of human life, to satisfy the waste and desolate land and to make the ground put forth grass? Who has the wisdom to number the clouds? Or who can tilt the water skins of the heavens when the dust runs into a mass and the clods cling together? Do you know the laws of the heavens? Can you establish their rule on the earth? Then Job answered the Lord, I know that you can do all things, and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes.
In the book of Job, the suffering protagonist finally has his encounter with God. But as we've just heard, it's not much of a revelation. God proclaims his own mastery over all creation and says that his ways are as inexplicable to human understanding as they are unquestionable. Job accepts this answer. And then, in a particularly strange twist, the story ends with Job getting back everything that he'd lost. His health returns, his family who had died, and the fortune that he'd lost are all restored. It's almost as though God is rewarding him for his understanding and his forbearance, which seems completely to contradict the broader message of the story, which is that human suffering is beyond notions of reward and punishment. Jason Kalman.
By and large, the most important interpreters ignored that ending. Maimonides, for example, in the 12th century, his interest with the book stops when God appears. Job is rewarded in certain ways by the knowledge of the deity that comes from the first-hand encounter. The property return after is really inconsequential. For a philosopher, there is nothing greater than an expansion of knowledge. And since for the medieval Jewish philosophers, it was knowledge of God that was the only thing worth seeking, the things lost by Job, his family, his property, even his health, is a loss of all those temporary things in the world. But Maimonides' argument, adopting sort of an Aristotelian God, we have a God who doesn't interact individually with human beings, rewarding them and punishing them for particular actions, but that bad things happen in the world because we perceive them as being bad. So earthquakes, for example, are particularly destructive, but imagine the tectonic plates did not move. And so as a result, we can protect ourselves because God has given us an intellect that we can use to help the community around us and ourselves overcome suffering.
What about the response to Job, which many have made? It's what you might call the rejection model that says, well, you know, if that's what God is like, just toying with an innocent man like a cat playing with a mouse, then I'm really unable to believe in or worship that kind of God. Does any part of you respond like that to the book of Job?
I certainly understand it, but the book is really troubling for those who want to maintain a relationship with God, not those who simply use it as a point of rejection. So if I read the text and I say this proves that there is no God of the kind I want to relate to, then I simply reject it. The question is, how do I maintain a relationship with a God who's presented in this way? And I think that's a far more significant question.
Well, it's interesting you talk about maintaining a relationship with the God of the book of Job, because in some respects, a relationship is precisely what that God disavows. God's engagement with Job, apart from allowing him to be afflicted with suffering, is limited to saying, you know, I'm God and you're human, you don't understand me, so keep quiet and just take what's meted out to you.
Well, I think there is that issue, but there's also the fact that Job demands a personal encounter with God and God actually responds. I might not like what God says, but the fact that God shows up, I think, offers a redemptive note.
One of the most distinctive elements in the Jewish tradition, that you see it throughout the history of Judaism, is that there is a pronounced strain in Judaism that sees no problem in protesting God's injustices.
Robert Eisen.
One of the things I find most moving about the Jewish tradition is that from the Bible onward, it's in the Bible itself, but certainly in rabbinic literature and onward, Jews did not necessarily take God's side. And often you have rabbinic figures basically yelling at God and saying, how can you do this? It becomes especially pronounced in the Middle Ages when Jews are undergoing horrific persecutions and being slaughtered. For instance, in the Crusades, you have Jewish literature that is written protesting against God and, in fact, calling him to task and saying, you know, Isaac wasn't sacrificed, and yet we're being sacrificed. And I think that's a very distinctively Jewish approach.
What about the end of the story? We've mentioned the way in which it's made the book problematic for readers who are addressing questions that come up through the Holocaust, the experience of suffering there. Job is apparently rewarded, which seems to contradict everything that's gone before. How do you read that ending?
Well, it is a very troubling ending, and let me share with you the comments of a couple of the more obscure commentators in the Jewish tradition who basically think that it was tacked on as a way of kind of just appeasing the masses. You know, in other words, Job isn't rewarded in the end, but the author had to put something in there to make them feel good. I'd like to go in a different direction by saying that it is part of the book, and the issue of whether God rewards him is one thing, and I'm not sure I have a good answer to that, but the thing that really strikes me about it is that he gets back into life. Who's Job at the end of this incredible series of tragedies? Is he a broken person who simply gives up? No. He goes back, he raises a family, he gets married, he raises a family. And that, to me, is the most important message that I think a Jew can respond to, and maybe any human being, which is that if you experience tragedy, you know, don't give up. The fact that Job engages in a dialogue, the fact that at certain points of the text he protests against God, I think that's very modern. That appeals to my sense of the need to talk about injustice, to engage God in dialogue in which you question him. I think we should all do that, all people that are people of faith. And again, the fact that in the very end, Job has enough faith to raise a second family. Many Jews lost families in the Holocaust, and it just is a marvel to me that they made a new life in Europe, America, and raised children again. So having that faith, not necessarily in God, but in human living and in moving on past suffering, you know, I see that in Job, and I find that very inspiring.
It's one of those few books, I think, in the Bible that says, life isn't about control. And I think that's something that touches us in the 21st century. We're all control freaks. We all want to be in control.
Laurie Woods.
And we can't control God, and Job realises he can't control anything that's going on in his life. So he sits back, not so much agnostically, because he says, as I said before, he knew God through tradition, but now through life, experience, suffering, agony, he's come to know God in a different kind of way. And through struggle, he has been able to emerge transformed. I had an experience with a student group I had, master's people, a couple of years ago. And we were talking about this thing, we were talking about the Book of Job. And one of these students had been a nurse, and she was in palliative care. And she said, when we were doing our training in palliative care, she said the tutor sat us around in a group and posed this scenario. A father has just witnessed, he just sat by the bedside of his teenage son, and the boy has just died. And you come along as the nurse, and he looks up at you with tears running down his face, and he says to you, where's my son now? What are you going to say? And this particular girl was in my class. She said, I was packing death because I really didn't know what to say. And she said, I was so fearful of offering platitudes, Christian platitudes. She said, and some of the nurses in the group did offer those kinds of things from their own faith tradition. She said, but I just couldn't bring myself to say those kinds of things. And sometimes pat answers, you know, just don't work. I guess you could go back to another platitude and say, stuff happens. And part of the positive aspect of struggle is to move on, to be transformed. I mean, that's easy for me to sit here and say that. And it's in one sense, it's a bit of a platitude to say, oh yes, through suffering a person can be made better and improve and work beyond it and so on. That's not an easy one to swallow when you are watching your house burn down or at the funeral of a loved one. But we all know that we can take the next step beyond that. We can move beyond that and perhaps arrive at a position of some kind of faith or a position of comfort in our own relationships, either relationship with God or relationship with those around us. But bottom line for me anyway is that that'll be a permanently tough question.
On ABC Radio National, you've been listening to Encounter. Guests this week were Laurie Woods, Robert Eisen, Jason Kalman, Peter Curti, Mark Vernon and Javi Carell. Readings from the Book of Job were by Tony McGregor and the studio producer was Andre Shabanov. Don't forget to check the Encounter website. Go to abc.net.au/rn, choose Encounter from the program list, and there you'll find a full transcript of this week's program, as well as streaming audio and podcast links. Thanks for your company this week. I'm David Rutledge.
ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.